Good afternoon.
Could be difficult.
I think we'll get underway. It's about 1:05. I'm Martin Tweedale. David Gullah, the director of the Ronning Center, and I and a couple other people organize these cafes. And we're having them this fall on the general theme, is everything up for sale. And this theme is taken from a book. This book by Michael Sandel, a political philosopher at Harvard, which came out not too long ago. And it discusses markets and market values and the substitution of market values for other values. And the various topics for our cafes this fall are taken from portions of this book. I have some copies of the book on commission from Audrey's, and I can sell them to you for $17.85 a piece, if anybody wants. Right. Last time we had sort of a general discussion with an actual video of Professor Sandel discussing one of these topics, and we're going to continue through the series. The next week, the topic is, you can't have all of me, but can I sell you a part? It's about selling body parts and things like plasma, and renting out body parts and from surrogate motherhood, and this sort of thing. And in other words, introducing a market into this general area of body parts. And the animateur for that is going to be Elizabeth Panusiuk, who now teaches at Grand McEwen University, but is was a student. She received a PhD from the University of Alberta, my department, the philosophy department. And then we're going to go on for just about every 2 weeks, except at the very last one on the 7th of December, follows the previous one by just 1 week. I have some schedules. If you haven't already picked up a schedule, I've got some schedules up here to bring you up to date on. Now, today, the topic is queue jumping, or pay your dough and jump the queue. And I'm very happy to have as our animateur for this session Professor Fred Judson, who's Professor Emeritus from the Political Philosophy Department here at the U of A. He taught at the in that department from 1986 to 2010. He received his B.A. from Lewis and Clark University and both his M.A. and Ph.D. here from the U of A. His specialty was Latin American politics, and I was just talking with him. He spent a lot of time in Nicaragua and assisting or advising or something or other with the Sandinista government when it was in power back some decades ago. So Fred's going to animate the discussion. He'll talk in the usual way for 15, 20 minutes to set up the issue, and then it becomes discussion as usual, and we'll continue on until maybe sometime between 2:15 and 2:30, and take a break for 15 minutes, and then come back for a wrap-up discussion. So, Fred.
Take it away.
Thanks, Martin. Thanks, David, and everybody for being here. This isn't the kind of thing I normally do. That is, engage in any discussion of philosophical matters. It's far easier just to pronounce as a professor, as some of you will no, than to do that. Do I need more sound?
Just a little closer.
Okay. First couple of comments. I hadn't read any of Michael Sandel before. I was aware of his profile. And as a person of the, let's say, long-established academic left, I first heard of him with my usual degree of left-wing skepticism when I hear a polished liberal democratic theorist hold forth. Reading the book hasn't changed my mind about that. Nonetheless, there are things that even old Marxists can get from polished and intelligent liberal democratic theorists. We can even get some things from outrageously right-wing theorists from time to time, particularly if we're looking for straw men to smash. So I will look forward, in fact, to acquiring the famous volume Justice by Dr. Sandel, and I will read it because I'm interested in theories of justice, just as I'm actually more interested in practices of justice than theories, and that's where there's a lot of room for critique, as I'm sure you are familiar with. The other thing, in Nicaragua, I was fortunate enough to have some time in Nicaragua in the 80s while the Sandinistas were attempting a popular and somewhat socialist revolutionary transformation in conditions of liberal constitutional democracy, I might add. It was multi-party elections all through the time that they were there. They were not an authoritarian left-wing dictatorship, despite the beliefs established in Washington for years and years, and they prevailed. They still think that that's what was going on there. That wasn't the case. But my small role, when I had a real chance to dig in and be there for the first time for a year in 85 and 86, when the U.S. jets would be flying over Managua at between regularly 2 and 3 a.m. in the morning to create those sonic booms that kind of interrupt your sleep patterns. No more deep sleep that particular year. And then you could go down to the beach like some of us sybaritic supporters of the regime would occasionally do, because you could eat a lobster for $1 and Sandinista army trucks would pick you up and you could hitchhike from the city down to the coast anytime, no problem, it wasn't menacing. So we'd go down there and try to perfect our body surfing, and what spice shall we have with a lobster this time? And you could go down there, and in between bouts of body surfing, you could see the aircraft carriers offshore. Just to remind Nicaraguans who really runs the hemisphere and what the empire might do if Nicaraguans had the audacity to continue to support electorally as well as in mass mobilizations and other forms of concrete popular agency the regime, as it was called in Washington, of the Sandinistas. A little bit of hardball was being played there between the empire and the only country to have been deemed so dangerous that for the first time since World War II, an American president declared a national emergency. That was Mr. Reagan. And the country that was so threatening to the country that would soon take the Soviet Union right out of the superpower sweepstakes game by overarming and driving them under, etc. A number of other things happened there too. But Ronald Reagan deemed a country with not a single working Otis elevator in the entire country to be such a threat. And that national emergency endured for several years. Well, I was in that terrible threat during all those years, and I'd like to think that the tremendous international support from all around the world for that democratic and, yes, radically transformative project might proceed. It didn't really, but we can talk about that later, perhaps. But we're here to talk about Mr. Sandel and his ideas. So I'll just throw out a couple of responses. Sometimes, you know, we go line by line and we're looking to pick apart an argument or find the logical flaws in it, or we look for the where the logic might lead, and think we can then argue that the person's premises were off in the first place. I'm not going to go after that, but in responding, here are a couple of things that occurred to me. One, Sandel certainly understands that capital bears culture. It may destroy culture. It certainly generates a culture. And often, as we've seen in the history of modernity, capitalist modernity, that is the set of cultural values and precepts and premises about the nature of life and what constitutes the good life that achieves domination. In fact, arguably, if capital's ideas do not achieve domination in a class-divided society, then their general project is probably flawed and they don't achieve the power that the class more or less dictates as its historical goal. Everybody then assumes to some degree or another, you might say, the import of those dominant ideas. And frequently, people stop thinking critically about where the ideas and the values that they live by actually come from. That's a superb achievement in a strategy of domination. It's often unconscious, of course. I'm not arguing that a ruling class always knows what it's doing. To quote Thurberg, was it? How does the ruling class rule, 1970? Tony might remember that one. Okay, so there's that. Now, Sandel understands that capital does generate a culture. It develops and evolves, of course, and as it has during all of capitalist modernity. Good point. Thank you, Sandel. But I find that he unconsciously or willfully wishes to subsume class as an analytical category, as something that can assist us to understand the dynamics of a culture within which we are living, and its possibilities for change, and how it might move in time and not, in fact, remain static. I think he underplays that element, let's say, in the whole presentation about market values and how we assess the impact and penetration of market values in those realms of our societies that don't necessarily pertain just to the behavior of commodities in the marketplace. So it's, for me, partly an older discussion that comes up in the social sciences when I'm reading Sandel. That discussion, you might say, is how to close the gap, the conceptual and argumentative gap, between critical political economy approaches to understanding society and liberal democratic readings of that society. And since it is modern capitalist society that he's writing about, I don't feel bad in saying it is capitalist morality that he asks us to examine. Now, he presents it as a set of values that are larger than the capitalist class's dominant ideas. I would argue most of society has internalized those ideas and either forgotten or abjured the responsibility or just found it too much work to approach it in a critical sense. Hence, I say, we're kind of unconsciously aping the values of the dominant groups. The last point here that I found interesting in a very general sense, both in this chapter, you know, a wonderful chapter with superb hair-raising examples of things people do. I hadn't known the extent of all of these. I knew of some of them, but I'd been reading this out loud, in fact, to Marion occasionally, going, oh, this might raise your eyebrows, you know, such and such is sold on the behind the kneecap of somebody, you know, there's a logo here. Well, where do we line up? If they're paying me $1,000 to tattoo the back of my knee with a logo, I can do that. No, actually, we didn't line up for that. All right. His point here, how do we value goods, per se, when they are moving about as commodities, whether they're goods or services? And I'm happy that he extends this notion of goods, of course, to that realm that we call public goods and the public good. An interesting wordplay there between the plural and the singular form. What is the public good and what are public goods? Very lastly, is there any use value in a labor theory of value when thinking about Mr. Sandel? Or does exchange value, which I think he's talking about largely in the book, cancel out any notion of use value? That's for you old Marxists out there. Well, let's have some discussions here, and I'm not going to defend Mr. Mandel. I probably won't even defend myself.
David has this.
How do you guys usually proceed?
Right,
you just throw things from where you are,
and people go down. But I was wondering whether, in order to sort of facilitate the discussion, because not everybody has read the book.
Yeah.
If you could sort of get more specific about the values that it's not so much the capitalist class wants to see, but the capitalist class finds comfortable. Makes the capital society comfortable with itself. What are these values that that you think we've internalized?
There was a line someplace in Uncle Carl's works where he said that the essence of the transformative essence of capitalism as he perceived it in the 19th century was in fact on the subjective and the cultural and the values plane. And he said that the tendency within capitalism, maybe paraphrasing Clausewitz, the tendency within war is towards total war, always and total, unbarred, no obstruction to the total violence of total war. Marx said that the tendency within capitalism was towards the commodification of absolutely everything. I recall that particular line. Now, in a way, isn't Mandel arguing
Sandel
that this... Where did I go with
Mandel's
that?
Mandel's our mayor. Mandel's our mayor.
I wasn't even thinking of Ernest Mandel. Somebody whose ideas might be pertinent here. Yeah. No, I think Sandel is on to that, but of course without being a critical political economist in any way. He understands that this is, he doesn't want to talk about stages or phases or the evolution of capitalism. He wants us just to kind of, I think in the moment. What's this moment? The moment for him is largely defined as the United States. But, of course, it extends well beyond that to the world of a plenitude of commodities, you might say, where the access to enjoying, consuming those commodities is merely your access to credit. In fact, you don't even need the cash anymore. You just need the possibility of a promise to pay, which is, I think, is another element that for me didn't get played up enough, namely the financialization dynamics of the last 30 years. Now, he speaks to us of the last 30 years, and he, in terms of the increasing commodification of our daily exchanges. And I like the fact that I like his posing of exchanges as well beyond strictly commercial, buy this, consume that, sell it, take the profits. This is a more nuanced argument about the penetration, the saturation, as he says, of the values of market, the marketplace, a market economy, having become the cultural values of a market society. I like the slight distinction that he makes there, and I like the way that he draws the analytical threads between the sphere of pure economy and the sphere of society, and what are the dominant values and the discourses about things that matter or don't matter to us, and how that's been penetrated and saturated by the discourses and values shown by behaviors, collective behaviors, such that we come to the point where he says, this is pretty alarming. And he gives us plenty of alarming cases of where there are issues of fairness and corruption, et cetera. Is it right that a poor person sells a kidney? Is it wrong? Why would it be in any case? For me, all this stuff that I've kind of been ruminating on out loud, it is underlying what he is helpfully presenting us. And he's doing it, of course, in a context where he believes that American democracy in particular, if it ever was truly healthy in the sense that he wants it to be during the history of the Republic, it's definitely in decline. He finds the place is sick. The country is sick. It has a sick value system. He's attempting to diagnose it and tell us how it got sick. I don't think it's a complete narrative on how it got sick.
Well, I'll take a shot at one point, because you did refer to his discussion, or his, shall we say, his use of the concept of class.
His non-use, almost.
Well, I think that the one of the points that he makes just toward the end of the book is that the penetration of market values creates class separation in situations where, under earlier conditions, people of different classes were brought into a relationship to each other, a relationship, in fact, of equality.
Like the ball game example.
The ball
right?
game, yeah. Exactly. And I was wondering, you know, he poses the question at several points, what things are should be off limits to market values? And this seemed to me to be one of the few criteria that he offered as a positive alternative. Something should not become a market commodity if making it so broke up society. How valid do you think his analysis is?
Well, I think it's valid if the premise can be established that society was at some point in the past closer to the ideal of equality and mixing. That's what he really was unhappy about. He called it the boxification of U.S. popular culture, sports culture in particular, having these expensive boxes for corporate donors and consumers of hockey to be up there for X thousands of bucks per pop. Meanwhile, the hoi polloi are down below. And isn't it terrible that golden age when the industrial honchos and the hoi polloi used to get together and have a hot dog and drink a beer?
Well, I'm not weeping for them bygone days, because they wasn't like that anyway. So I thought that that was kind of feeble on his part, frankly. I understand he loves baseball, and that did come through. But I didn't find it persuasive. Now, I said it was valid. I think it's valid to the degree that he can show, and I think he shows substantively, that at this point, those dynamics that he wants to call boxification, the separation of parts of society under the stresses of commodification and the commodity culture that go with it, sure, I can see that it's going further towards its logical outcomes, which is, that, let's not mince words, which is plutocracy. That is, the ordering of society by degrees of wealth and the political rule of society by the most wealth. We're there. Is it matters of degree or is it matters of transformation? I don't find that we're in a different epoch. I'm old school. It's been underway for 250 years. It's called capitalist modernity. And if you want to get technical, of course, we've got elements of monopoly capital, and we've got these dynamics of unregulated financialization. These didn't just come from people thinking them up. As a good old Marxist, I can tell you that it is the dynamics of accumulation that are behind that. And it is the collective and individual decisions of capitalists and their states, their bourgeois capitalist states. Doesn't mean that there aren't capitalists in those states. In fact, most people aren't, as we know. But it does mean that those states essentially are organized to privilege those interests that are economically dominant. There's no mystery here. Even liberals can get this. Notice that they're running candidates in Toronto who say these things. Chrystia Freeland, for example.
Well, I think there's a good point there, in that the golden age of the past turns out on examination to have been rather more like iron filings. But and of course, if he attended that ball game, it may be true that rich and poor were together, but I wonder what about black and white. I'm not at all sure about that. But if you look at it from the point of view of the future, maybe he has a point, that we need systems that will help to integrate, or at least what shall we say, at least connect up the society, and that practices and values that obstruct that sort of connection need to be fought. Does that make any sense?
Sure it does. I'm not against dialogue across the class gap. After all, if you, in cases where you don't have that dialogue and you have a capitalist society, it often degenerates to a form of fascism, because that's the only way to maintain the order that privileges the plutocracy. So you need a buy-in one way or another, right? Now, normally that buy-in has been the production and packaging of a quite palatable set of values that appear to speak for the majority and that they can agree with. For example, working classes historically do not vote for socialist parties. They vote for the politicians and the parties of essentially the ruling class. And yeah, there are lots of reasons why that happens. sometimes it happens because the ideas are broad enough. So the idea that we're all in this together, we can get together on Sunday at the ballpark, and me, the auto mechanic, can actually go, yeah, I'm the same as the dude that owns the ballpark here. I can have a beer and a hot dog just like him. And that helps. I mean, the Roman emperors knew that circuses and bread also helped out maintain rule in tough times. So I can buy some of it. Dr. Sandell wants more civility than he sees around. And he says he sees less civility in public discourse, as well as on the streets, than 30 years back, including this example of the ball game. So whatever point of the political spectrum we're on, generally, we can lament the decline of civility, and we can lament the decline of civil political discourse. And nobody is saying that isn't the case in the States or in Canada. So clearly there's something there. Do I think he's pulling the thread that will unravel and give us clarity? I don't really think so. I certainly don't think he's going to give us any lever of mobilization from this kind of analysis.
Thank you. You know, this sadness around the loss of civility, I think, is one of the most essential parts of the book, and maybe he's not the man to unravel and change, but he's putting out something that, yes, we're aware of, but so many people are really have not stopped and thought about what it really means. When I read, for example, I think it was that book, because I read it, I think, a couple of years ago now, but the nouveau riche, or upper class people, mothers that are too busy or think it's beneath them now just because of their sense of entitlement, that they'll hire people to stand in line at Disneyland for them, and that has become a norm.
Yes.
And it's just think about that is a norm now. It's so preposterous to me to think that goes on as every day now, and he cites example after example of that kind of sad case where we really are so isolated from one another as a result of, in my mind, that sense of entitlement that comes from this, you know, we're in babies, 30-year-olds nowadays, it was in womb, that kind of influence, and because of that busy schedule, internet, all sorts of stuff, I wonder how many times people will stop and think about how absurd this free market has become. It's just a comment, but that's what I seem to recall. The thing I got out of that the most was, thank you, it's like Bill McKibben with enough. Mm-hmm. You know? These kind of books have to be written and talked about, and I, for one, am very happy. And that's all I want to say. Thanks.
Thanks. You know, as you were saying that, Maureen, it struck me, too, that the fragmentation of the contemporary person's attention by the multiplicity of media moments available to us, whether it's here, or I'm looking up there, or I'm listening over here, he is making a bit of a point about the difficulty of people to be reflective and to concentrate on matters like what constitutes the public good, or is there any meaning in my actual behavior of purchasing this service or commodity and then consuming it, and the social circumstances in which I do that, such as I don't have the time to stand in line for that opera ticket, and I don't have the time to get that entry to the rides at Disneyland, but I do have the money.
Not that important.
To pay for it. So the money as the solution to all is cast against the fragmentation of the universe of choices many, you and I would agree, are false choices. 49 types of toothpaste, when three types would probably cover most of us. But, you know, so the creation of wants is something I wouldn't have minded. And he's probably covered it in another book. But the modern capitalism's production of an endless
selection
flow of stuff for us to buy and consume must have something in his mind to do with the decline in civility, with the decline in the collective popular capacity to even consider these matters on a reflective type of plane, rather than, as he starts to get into, choice of political moment. We now apparently choose to vote in responding to the same marketing ploys and techniques that influenced us to choose that CD, that trip, that bag of chips. So that it's just the same, isn't it? I go and vote, or I go and buy some pizza. And I don't want those two things to take any more time out of my busy day either than they do. I'd be interested to know if he's written about that kind of degradation. Because we're kind of looking, too, at what he saying is behind what has come to pass.
I think he yearns, and I do too, for like a simpler life. A simpler life. These choices are insanity-making. And there's no, it doesn't even leave room for thought, because it's just so endemic. It's just pushed in your face all the time. So I think that's what he learns for, people having less and being more comfortable with it.
And he doesn't want to be a reverse elitist either. He doesn't want to look at the, let's say, the consumption hypnotized masses' lack of reflective capacity when it comes to issues of the public good. He doesn't want to be the reverse elitist that says only people like him can understand the importance of us having come to this commodified pass for the degradation of public discourse and for the franchising of democracy, to paraphrase the book by Alan Wolfe in the 70s, where you can get all the democracy that your money can buy you. PACs would be a good example, for example. Mm-hmm. Nor was he given the time, I think, in the book to go into the institutional and deliberate creation of the values he now decries. By long work of right-wing think tanks, in particular, to diminish the impact of a notion of the public good and to consider everything as a rational choice, and the assiduous and multi-billion dollar work done by individuals and groups such as the Koch brothers to push these ideas, such that at present on all the U.S. mainstream and even the PBS shows, you get the spokespersons of these outfits who are spouting the same elitist stuff as 45 years ago. Only now it's mainstream, right-wing elitist stuff about how nobody should threaten the right of people to do what they will with their money. And we're really talking about the people with the most money when we say it's wrong to curtail their right to do what they want with their hard-earned money. And that's the discourse that kind of dominates and prevails at the present. I'm sure he's very thoughtful about how we got to that, how we got to that spot in the majority, because he's looking at the majority as the hope for the future of this democracy, which is in trouble in the United States. But he has a perspective on it, an analysis on it, that surely almost nobody in the majority would actually share. So how the hell is he supposed to communicate with them and get them to abjure these worlds of illusion and consumption and their conviction that money resolves all, and if you don't have the money, that's your fault? It's not laid at the hands of some uneven structure. It's sort of back to that individual. He understands that poverty, for example, and even ignorance and the lack of capacity to discuss such public policy issues is exactly a desired outcome for some interests in society. Mm-hmm. They don't want to fix that problem. It works really well for them.
Just to close, it's not working for the most of the Americans now. It's still,
but they
just
don't know it.
Yeah, well, they're starting to learn real fast, you know, and they'll really learn it with economic collapse or environmental collapse, whatever comes first. But no, I think there's more people that are willing to listen to this and hear it, and I think that's his point, is just to put it out there so you can think about it.
Certainly agree that loss of public stability is a major problem. But it's interesting that the ones who seem most upset about it, or who you normally hear most about it from, tend to be the right wingers and the religious right, who are supporting the very programs that help to eliminate stability,
yes,
help to cause a problem. And usually it is these people on the right who are most vocal about the sort of loss of manners or etiquette or anything like that. And, I just find it almost surreal that someone can stand up and bemoan the lack of civility when they're sponsored or being backed by the very economic powers that are responsible for that loss.
Blindness comes in all forms.
Is it fair to ask a question if you haven't read the book? I apologize because I was here last time. Does the author say anything at all about whether capitalism either eliminates or abrogates or harms human values such as love and caring?
Yes, in fact, he does get onto that. You know, he's, and I'm thinking about your comment too here, Randy, about the decline of civility remarked upon by those whose agency drives it right to that point anyway. It struck me that our author Sandel is compelled to tilt discursively against the domination of kind of hard concepts, you might say, like value, profit, degrees of consumption, things like that, wealth increase and so forth, GNP. And he's attempting to say that values like love, civility, affinity with nature, the sense that the good life is constituted for a lot of people by access to public goods, public spaces like parks, a functioning public health care system, public transport within the reach of everybody's economy, things like that. That the value universe that he feels is at threat is at its core constituted by exactly those values you have mentioned. They're also exactly the most subjective and the least amenable to the rational choice discourses and social dynamics and behaviors that now characterize most exchange in society. So that's a real dilemma. He uses the language of the morality of the market, crowding out these deeper, more human values. He doesn't say the first set of values are inhuman. He does sort of quietly suggest that they may behave in inhuman ways once they've reached this kind of critical point where they dominate. And so, yeah, he's actually more alarmed than comes through in his prose in the book about the subsidence, or it isn't the subsidence, it isn't the disappearance of the positive values, it's their crowding out in the public sphere in particular, but also, of course, in the individual minds of citizens. I thought that was subtle in the book, a really important part of it.
The subtle's good, because I think of capitalism as not having conscience. So I wouldn't expect him to deal with it if he's talking about strictly the value of capitalism. So subtle covers things very well.
Yes,
thank you.
It has to. You know, in my wonderful and fun career as a prof here at the U of A, it was always kind of fun as a person on the left to tilt against the conviction and entitlement discourses of those touting rational choice, how commodity decisions really were the most important ones. And I found myself frequently resorting to citing poets, musicians, novelists, etc., in my classes, rather than having my people read endlessly boring political science text about these matters. Instead, I found sometimes that to translate the lines of a contemporary revolutionary song, this is 30 years ago or 20 years ago in Central America, could cut through a lot of stuff. Or to read an interview with a young indigenous woman in Peru and why she had joined Sendero Luminoso, right, the Maoist guerrilla group, in the 80s, instead of endless graphs and political science language about things. I suppose I could have occasionally been accused of not being sufficiently rigorous or loyal to my discipline. But I was in the classroom and I lived it and I saw what worked, and sometimes it's the poetry and the nuance and the subtle that really help people understand something.
I really enjoyed your presentation, Fred, and I don't want to do anything to pee you off. This might get me into a bit of trouble with you, but I'll take my chances.
Then we'd have to go for a run.
A bit worse than death right now.
Could be worse.
I guess what I wanted to say was, addressing the issue of commodification, the market economy and stuff like that, in a sense, and I'm oversimplifying here a lot, but we have a society like the United States which mythologizes the degree of personal freedom that exists. But in many respects, the freedoms that do exist in the United States, we could say, are often unparalleled in terms of our right to say certain things, to find a media outlet to say certain things, even if Fox News and the established media organizations don't allow us the possibilities for expressing oppositional and dissenting opinions are still considerable in the US. But at the same time, there is this sense that the US mythologizes personal freedom, and societies which do that, in a sense, totally sacrifice any concerns with equality, equity, and social justice. But on the other hand, those societies which have mythologized equality and equity, and I'm thinking of the so-called societies of existing socialism when they still existed, are often prepared to to sacrifice personal freedom and political, the rights to political opposition. So I guess what I'm really interested in is when a society comes into crisis, quite often its most fundamental assumptions become more transparent at that time because they're contested. And often new opportunities arise. They're not always capitalized, they're not always able to be realized, but they come into existence. And it's rather like, as Marx quoted Hegel, the owl of Minerva only takes flight when the shades of night are falling. In other words, that the possibilities for new things to develop only happen often when a society is in crisis and the end of an epoch of some sort is about to happen. So I guess what I'm saying in a roundabout way is anyone who traveled throughout Eastern Europe before the fall of communist governments, of the Iron Curtain, whatever you'd like to call it, would probably realize that central planning was often what we might call today a rather clunky document, a clunky apparatus, that it frequently did not meet the needs of large numbers of consumers for very basic consumer goods, things like soap and for women, nylon stockings and stuff like that, which we may regard as frivolous and trivial, but for many consumers in Poland and the German Democratic Republic, these and other examples were often difficult to obtain or unobtainable. I remember going to numerous restaurants in Czechoslovakia and Poland, and the only thing that was available was Fleisch Kotleten, which is pork chops, and you would get nothing else, beef or chicken. So I guess what I'm saying is when a society comes into crisis, new ideas, new opportunities come onto the horizon, even if they're not realized. So when Czechoslovakia was invaded by the Warsaw Pact countries in 68, there were economists in Czechoslovakia, Otto Schick was one of them, Walter Lieberman was another, who were suggesting with Dubček that maybe we can restructure the economy, we can maybe restrict central planning to what they were calling strategic public goods, to use your phrase, but we can open up a market economy for more basic consumer items, which the majority of the population looked towards the West with tremendous envy, because a lot of that stuff was unavailable in the same way in Eastern Europe. And when Gorbachev began the program of perestroika and glasnost, similar ideas came into the Soviet Union that maybe we can have a two-tier economic structure, that we could have a centralized democratic planning structure for strategic infrastructural industries, but we could open up a consumer market for basic consumer durable goods, because the argument was, and goes back in capitalist philosophy as well, that the market is sensitive to human needs. We may try to argue that these are all manufactured needs, or as Marcuse says, false needs. I don't completely buy that argument. I think the marketplace is often an experimental zone where consumer preferences make themselves felt, and they're not all manufactured and fabricated. So I guess my question is, what possibilities do we see in the future for struggling against the huge structural inequalities in our society, maybe by nationalizing the means of production, distribution, and exchange, bringing that under popular democratic control, beginning to redistribute income in some meaningful way, but at the same time, maybe having a dual sector economy which still allows some kind of consumer preferences to be expressed in some kind of commodified form. My last point, I think the value of the labor theory of value, which of course predated Marx, I mean Adam Smith, Ricardo, was and still is that it forces us to connect the goods and services that we use to the fact that they are produced by human labor. It forces us, when we pick up a bar of chocolate, to realize that there is often semi-slave labor involved in the production of chocolate or in other commodities that we forget about. We just see them as commodities. But the labor theory of value reminds us that there is labor which is makes meaningful these commodities. Without human labor, they would be still chocolate would never be processed, oil would never come out of the ground, bushels of wheat would still remain unharvested. Marx's great achievement was to take that extra step beyond the labor theory of value into the theory of surplus value, in which he shows that although the workers may believe they're being paid a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, they're not. They're only being paid for a small fraction of the working day. The rest of the value they produce during the working day is extracted from them in the form of surplus value. So I guess this long-winded intervention is centrally planned economies have had big problems because they have not always been able to respond to consumer preferences, and they certainly haven't avoided the building up of elitist social strata, if you don't want to call them classes, the nomenclatura, as they were called, in the privileged groups who had the country cottages, who had access to hard currency stores and the whole bit. I mean, they were a privileged social strata. So centrally planned economy does not answer the problems of inequality. But in conjunction with a dual sector economy, we could begin the process of reforming our economy to meet the real genuine forms of consumer needs. Thanks.
Thanks, Tony. I recall reading about an encounter between Castro and Jean-Paul Sartre on that very question of needs and wants. They actually agreed that there isn't a sufficiently precise cut between wants and needs, so that an economy that meets people's needs may be also an economy that meets their wants. It went to the question of the creation of needs, right? And such that there were, do we have basic needs, and is there just a basket of them, and beyond that all is cream and dessert, or that's where we apply the principles of scarcity, whether it's within a market economy or within the strictures of a centrally planned economy, because certain things are scarce, then access is made more difficult, etc., etc. It was an interesting philosophical discussion that took place in about 1970. Between the two of them, Sartre had visited Cuba, and a book came out of it, and I was reading that particular passage. It's long ago, but still, it struck me that they were nuanced in their discussion of the nexus between wants and needs. You and I would emphasize that the failures, the historic failures of the experiments of actually existing socialism in central planning were certainly bounded by military, cultural, and political hostility at the point of origin of those experiments, namely the Bolshevik revolution being invaded by 22 Western countries and troops on the land for 5 years, and all the other things that were done to limit the influence and power of the Soviet Union, and those experiments, in fact, to be attractive in the core as well as in the periphery during the middle and latter parts of the 20th century, before numerous dynamics, including inherent flaws in those models of central planning that were implemented, as well as this climate of hostility and so on and so forth, and arguably that the commodities that the socialist countries produced for exchange in the global capitalist economy were always going to be disadvantaged, of course, by another iteration of the law of value which prevailed from the West, and degraded their chances. Yeah, there were most, you know a lot more, Tony, about the really interesting experiments in market socialist economic organization at the end of the Yugoslav Republic and in a number of other places where they didn't get a chance to have implementation, such as in Czechoslovakia, where it wasn't the only two places in Eastern Europe after all, let alone the Soviet Union, where, let's say, much more innovative reviews and suggestions regarding balances within central planning with the consumer commodity production, for example, and in the case of Yugoslavia, the idea of almost Mondragon anarchist, very effectively organized businesses run by workers in Spain since the 30s and still functioning. That some of those kinds of models were certainly thought about, and many ideas, I think, were generated more from like the local realities, country by country, within the Balkans, parts of Eastern Europe. It is unfortunate that neither the grip on power of the Stalinists nor the perspective in the West among political elites, it was not in the West's strategic interest to see such projects flourish. That's one reason why they took Allende out after all, right, in Chile. You didn't want socialism with a human face. You wanted an ogre. Better to keep people in your own societies from thinking about the decline of love and civility and the capture of public consciousness by commodities as opposed to civic values. You didn't want something popping up over there that might look human and humane and actually viable. Not in the Cold War contention for people's minds. No, that was not convenient. So, as we know, most of that, to the degree that got any attention at all in the West, it was just laughed off. Or it was, these people are idealists, how can they think, that'll just never happen. There were two audiences for whom that message was meant, right? Those, quote, behind the Iron Curtain. Too bad for you, you're going to have to go all the way to capitalism to get anything good, which they haven't. Or, sure, go ahead and experiment. And then what? Then our citizens might think it's a good idea here? No, not going to have any of that. I can't, of course, answer your question, and you can't either. Namely, what sort of possibilities for the future do we see? I certainly can't go any further than you did. And you barely got us on the map.
Can't disagree with that at all. It's just that there is a legacy which goes much further back even than we've discussed. It goes back, I suppose, to mutual aid, Bakunin, mm-hmm. Kropotkin.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's a legacy we shouldn't forget. Maybe now is the time to recall some of these failed experiments and bring them onto the agenda again. Otherwise, we're confronted with two stark alternatives, neither of which appears to have worked.
Yeah, and you know, we maybe this is why a good liberal democratic political theorist like Sandel is important, because he can assist people all across the spectrum to move us towards, if not back, but at least towards these more nuanced values you were speaking of, sir, and wondering whether they were treated in Sandel's book. And a route to that is just thinking about the stuff we consume. I mean, we don't have to get technical and be persons who know the labor theory of value. But just to remember that stuff is made by people. And we know what a stretch that is when we see polling of children about, you know, where food comes from. Meat, for example. Oh, well, it's in a plastic package in a box in the market. human labor involved, no notion about that. That it's even part of nature, not much notion about that. So we've got a lot of work to do. You know, we've dumbed down to such a degree, gets replicated in our public education as well. I shouldn't be going there.
I don't know. I find now a lot of left-wing ideas and rhetoric a bit unreal. The Marxist view and anarchist views. Particularly here in North America. I mean, I think that capitalism and capitalist society has progressed to the point where these sorts of ideas really don't get any grip on a large number of people anymore, like they did back in the 19th and early 20th century. And I think I have a more positive view of Sandel's book here, because I think he's trying to come at people where they are. And what he's trying to do here is make them aware that there are values other than these values of the market, right? I mean, there are things which have value other than as a commodity of some sort. It struck home particularly with me when he talks about in a later chapter about environmental destruction and pollution, and his criticism of the permits, the market and permits to pollute, which he criticized openly in the New York Times and got roundly criticized for by a whole bunch of reigning economists. He's trying. I think he senses, and I think this is still true, that the mass of the people, they do still have some sort of feeling for those values that are not associated with the market. And if he can show them how those values are steadily being pushed out of any sort of public policy discussions whatsoever, that they'll have a rethink on that. And you know, if you're going to have a capitalism with a human face or socialism with a human face or whatever, well, what do we mean by a human face? Right. I think having a human face, as you were pointing out, is having these valuing quite a few things in a way that's not connected with their being commodities at all. And in fact, seeing that making them a commodity is pushing that whole value side of them out the window. And people, you know, I think it makes them, you know, sit back and think about that. We've regressed so far in the 20th century away from the sorts of both philosophical understandings of society and the values that have to be preserved in a humane society. That this is where you have to go. You have to start with that kind of an approach. He doesn't, he says, yeah, markets can do great. I mean, they can be great engines of prosperity. And he's not overlooking the fact that, you know, if you get a radically unequal class society, markets are going to radically favor the people who have money. He's perfectly aware of that, and it comes up at several places. In fact, that's I think that feature of markets is sort of dimly understood by most people, that They run into grave problems when you've got large inequalities of wealth. And that's why in Canada, you know, I mean, we have a public health care system of sorts. I mean, that enables people who don't have money to get health care. They might not quite get as good as the rich get, but I mean, it's not that unequal. So we understand that at least for certain things, you've got to modify the market in that way. But you know, the criticism of the markets as being unfair, while quite valid in many ways, it doesn't go to this point about other values, because what you're saying is that all the goods are out there on the market. The problem is to make sure that they get distributed in a pretty fair way, or at least not a grossly unfair way, right? But all goods are commodities, you see. It's just a matter of getting them fairly distributed. And the surplus value thing of Marx is that sort of a criticism, which is valid. But, I mean, there's another sort of criticism to be run here, and that's what Sandel tries to do.
Lots of good criticisms there, actually. I was just thinking, well, given Sandel's imputed capacity to raise these issues and put them in the center of consciousness, it's too bad that he doesn't own Fox News, because then he'd get some exposure, right, beyond with the likes of us. And yeah, he can do an op-ed piece in the New York Times, but not even our students are going to see that, Martin, you know that. So it would be good if his voice was accessible. In fact, it would be good if I could impose it on most Americans for a while, right? Let's have a little tea.
Maybe Amy Goodman will get him on.
Maybe Amy will take him someplace.
So we'll take a break for 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Another thing which I liked about Sandel's book is that in a very polite and gentle way, he sticks some pins in the big balloon of neoclassical economics. And all these Harvard economists think they've got the world by the tail here. And in a way, I guess they do. But here's another aspect, which may be of the whole problem we've been discussing, that maybe you could comment on. And that is the role of academic economic theory in the 20th century, in the pushing aside of all values other than the values that things have by being commodities.
There's a great little book by Robert Heilbronner called The Poverty of Economic Thought. Came out about 20 years ago, actually, and I think neatly subsumed in layperson language, accessible to the likes of me, just how far off the rails current proponents of neoclassical economic precepts have gone. And that was written even before the destruction of the regulatory framework in finance. And things that had been assumed as holy writ by all economists were swept aside and have become basically the Ten Commandments. I mean, they've got a belief status. They're not to be questioned at all. They're sort of sacred. But Sandel is one of those who's going to say, well, no, Larry Summers, you really did get it all wrong. Look what happened. But Sandel didn't get named to be president of Yale or Harvard yet either, did he? But yeah, for sure, a current classical academic economics, it's hard to find a department that wants an economic historian. It's hard to find a department that wants to deal with theories of economic development other than the latest spreadsheet put out on the internet. So we've played our role in diminishing the range of thinking that can be done in a public discourses about essential public policy issues. And we've also been kind of, I think, at the public and popular level, we have largely accepted the statement that economics is a science. And just, it's out there. It's a premise. It's unquestioned. So all we have to do is hear that a politician says, well, economists agree that my policy is the best, period. unfettered markets, let's get rid of regulation. Nature doesn't have to calculate in to any of our considerations. It is possible to have unlimited growth. In other words, it's possible for the global economy to be in a state of terminal cancer, but we can't diagnose it as such. Nobody dares to. Nobody will. He does, to a degree.
Well, I'd like to raise a couple of questions that address what seems to me to be the limitations in Sandel's book. His critique of market values includes, I think, a critique of unfair markets. But that's only part of his argument. There's another part which says market values themselves have to be limited. He's not quite as explicit about what he put in their place. And as I've been thinking about it, I thought of Pope Francis's recent pronouncement. He wants a poor church serving the poor. If you reject the market, must you be poor? Now, that's a question that he doesn't address, but Pope Francis has at least put it on the table, and I just wonder where that alternative set of values fits in, or just how one can interrelate market and non-market values. And he doesn't, as I say, he's not very explicit about this. Can we beat him on that?
Mm-hmm. Perhaps that's beyond my ken, but what you raise makes me think about Carl Polanyi, whose 1944 book The Great Transformation came out in the same year as Hayek's The Path to Serfdom, which was a grand critique of all central planning, all regulation, all mitigation of the wonders of the marketplace. And, you know, Polanyi, looking at the 19th century's trajectory of kind of mercantilism, partial state capitalism, full-blown laissez-faire, and then the 30 years grand capitalist global crisis, 1870s through the 1890s, thought that he saw this dynamic in capitalist society where society would accept, because it saw the dynamic creation of wealth and the greater inclusion of greater and greater numbers within society moving towards a consumer's level of life with public goods, the rise of literacy, public education, urbanization, etc., that people understood at that basic community level that this genie which had been let out of the bottle could not be killed and should not be killed, but it ought to be ruled, governed, regulated, limited, and employed by society. He called that the double movement. The first movement was the unfettered accumulation of wealth and the domination by interests that pretty soon assumed monopoly proportions and a monopolist culture, and also had a culture of political entitlement where every government needed to bow to that economic elite's interests and dictates. That was the evolution of the modern capitalist state. He said that society would know that this was cancer. He didn't use that. And that it had to be regulated. And that this would be the second movement. So the second movement was society recognizing this and democratically imposing limits. So the antitrust movement in the States at the end of the 19th century, for example, would be one. The rise of the welfare state would be another one. That is, these regulatory structures to redistribute wealth, to govern the unfettered creation of wealth through this unregulated capitalism. It was the regulation. A lot of people who go back to Polanyi now say that we need a second double movement. We need a re-regulation. This actually seems to me more realistic. You were speaking about how 19th century and current Marxist thought might not really be enough with it to help us out here. I still think it helps us out to understand things, but it doesn't help us at all in our agency. I think our agency doesn't need to take lessons from flawed central planning or circumscribed and aggressed upon Stalinism or Third World Revolutions that might have had a shot at doing something a little more humane, etc. But I think that, without being specific, Polanyi's insight about society, even if democracy is wizened and curtailed under the impact of all of these market dynamics that Sandel is talking to us about, has the organic awareness and capacity to respond and say, it ain't right. And what recently has occurred that might help me be encouraged about that is nothing more nor less than the Occupy movement. It looks maybe to us now that it was a flash in the pan. I think it was representative of something a lot deeper, and that is the skepticism and concern of society in general that this unfettered capitalist accumulation model is not serving our interests, either collectively or as individuals and groups within the kind of society that that unfettered accumulation has been creating, including all the inequalities that Sandel speaks about that are inherent. And, not least, his other side of arguments, right? The corruption arguments. He shows us what rot can be wrought, if I can use a pun here, with that dynamic. And he's still got, whether you're a populist Marxist or a liberal Democrat or just a person that believes that representative democracy is good enough, there's something there for everybody in that critique that Sandel's offering us. For me, I go back to Polanyi to help me out What could Sandel be on about? Some kind of double movement. That's the best that I expect, Tony. I don't expect the outbreak of local level producers groups. I don't think, I think the level of industrialization is such that that's really problematic. It might still be feasible. That requires an awful lot of restructuring of large corporate entities, and as you and I know, that control will not be relinquished without a fight. And I think if there were a real threat to that kind of control, we would actually be in a rather authoritarian police state fascist condition right now, because the powers that be are powerful enough to make sure that they use the means of repression. But this is just kind of a nightmare scenario, right? I don't see the kind of consciousness around that would prompt such repression and coercion, because we don't have the mobilization. Even with the portent or the possibility or the foreshadowing of significant mobilizations along the lines of what we saw with the Occupy movement. And notice, that wasn't an Occupy the Workplace movement. It was really more about citizens as consumers in a world that Sandel is talking about, where it's apparent that the system is not fair. It's apparent that the system creates the corruption of all these public goods and these values that we think should be there to replace or begin to come back and crowd out the preeminence of some of these market values that have been crowding out community and human-oriented values. So he's onto something there, but without the help of Polanyi.
So earlier on, some others had touched on the point that Sandel makes. I haven't read the book, so about how the conscious feet was fractured, and also somebody later on made a point about.
Did you say the conscience of people?
Consciousness is fractured. Okay. And later on, also there was a comment about. Discussion of rational choice theory. And my question was, it's a question and a comment, is how much does Sandel speak to the difficulty for many people who are working in environments that require them to internalize ideas of rational choice theory? Many people working in corporate environments, business environments, they run basically, these are the ideas, this is the language you speak. And likewise, these people are also often will be great champions, like some of what champions, they understand Sandel's point about the dangers of market values, and they value love in their own personal lives, friendships, and that sort. And I guess the difficulty I'm pointing to is our ability to put on this, so now I'm working at my job, so I put on my rational choice theory hat without necessarily fully believing it, and now I'm back in my life, and how we somehow, it's hard to find where our center actually is at that point. And does Sandel at all speak to that, and is there a possibility when we have that kind of compartmentalization for some sort of synthetic attempt to connect these, for example, something like a market theory of rationality with some other notion of love or friendship in another sphere while separating them?
Thanks. This enables me to come back to where I started, actually, and I hope I'm agreeing with you rather than critiquing at all in your take on Sandel. No, in my reading of the book, he does not talk to me about how people are split between their work lives and their consumer lives. I wish that he had, actually. And for me, it goes back to the comment that, as an old Marxist, this is a book about exchange value. It's not about the production of value. It's about consumption and the behavior of individuals as consumers, largely, and the choices that we make and are confronted with as consumers. That's why I said I would have wanted him to go to the point of production, like any critical political economist is going to do in discussing the character of society and the main dynamics that move it or don't move it towards positive change or status quo or deterioration of democracy or a move towards authoritarianism. I think it would have been crucial, and hopefully he does think about stuff like that and wonders, what about this divide in, quote, the average working person who has to behave on the job, as the rational choice theorists have predicted we all will, and yet there's something disturbing, and you might face moral dilemmas when you leave your job and you go to make a choice out in the consumption world, but you're morally affronted by not just some of the commodities, but how they're produced, what their essence is. For example, an awful lot of people are distressed at the commodification in its many forms of women's bodies. That's old discourse. A phrase like that is from 40, 50 years ago of early second generation feminist theory. But it's no less disturbing now, right? What with what we do see in the commercialization of people's bodies. And so the average working person is going to go out and go, oh, I'm really uncomfortable with that. That runs against my human values. But of course, I can't take those values with me when I go to work tomorrow morning, right? Because they don't serve me at the workplace. So certainly there's a disjuncture. Marx spoke in the beginning of the alienation of working people from the process of labor and the process of extracting their surplus value. That's the original alienation we know about. Certainly there are more contemporary alienations as society secularizes but has little or no recourse to a spiritual realm or a spiritual discourse even, right? That's been kind of secularized out, and I think Sandel would probably agree with me if I assert that that's largely as well the shoving by market values of other values off the table and out of our own skulls. So it would have been a good thing, and maybe there's other writing, others here who know Sandel more, you know, investigating, all right, what is this split consciousness he's telling us is a central cultural product of these dynamics that have brought us to this point that he considers with great alarm. I personally would have liked to see him deal with that kind of thing. But that is me as an old Marxist saying, look, I think what happens at the point of production and the way that production is organized is a very important human nexus, both for our understanding things and for actually exerting power in case we get a chance to prompt any significant changes. If you don't understand the power you have, for example, at the point of production, then you're hardly going to be mobilized at the point of production, are you? All you're going to be able to do is go and say, that's terrible, I'm not going to buy chocolate there because I know the kids are enslaved in Ghana. Fine. Again, it's petty bourgeois individualism. It's your act. And the system currently appeals to us. If you don't like such and such, show you don't like it by boycotting a product. Don't even think about doing something where you work. That's another way in which it's been so successful, convincing us that we are powerless in any realm except as a consumer. And that's where we can defend our rights to choose and push away those who want to regulate some product out of our access. And that deep individualism, petty bourgeois individualism, you might say. Didn't McPherson write about that here in Canada? Possessive individualism? Here we are in another iteration of that same cultural product of our kind of capitalism, and you know, it's gone to that. I like your points.
I'm not sure if I understood what you said about at the production level. If it is when, if you were to pay me fairly for all that I'm producing, how is that going to teach me a different value, though?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I paid you fairly at the point of production, to be truly fair, I would stop being the owner of the factory where you work, and you would become a group of workers that own that, okay? That is the only way you would be paid fairly for the product of your labor, is if you own the means of production. That's the description, that's the definition of capitalism. I can't pay you fairly because I have to take some of the value that you have produced and take it for myself. In fact, beyond what I need to keep that building functioning. That's profit, that's exploitation under the labor theory of value. But I don't think that is at all what Sandel is going on. I'm sorry for the little deviation here. And nor what I'm going on when I say that I wish he had spent time considering citizens at the point of production as opposed to citizens going to the store or online and buying stuff. Mostly his book is about buying and selling stuff. It's not about the making of stuff. So I'm on about the making of stuff. I think that's where people can feel their power, can maybe think different values than market values. Now, partly, we are able as consumers to be aware of what happens at the point of production for some things. You saw that terrible disaster of the fires in the Bangladesh clothing factories, right? Yeah. Everybody who saw that, almost everybody, if they buy products from those factories, they feel some human guilt. They feel bad about what happened with those workers. They understand that those workers aren't being paid very well. They understand that they're in inhuman, near slavery working conditions. The more nuanced of us understand that that's one of the few places in the Bangladeshi economy where a woman can get work. And it's one of the few places where there's work available in the Bangladesh economy. Armed with that knowledge, I think Sandel would argue, a consumer can make a reasoned choice to keep non-market values in the center of their consciousness as they behave as a consumer. Namely, I feel empathy for those people who are working in those conditions. I feel bad that I bought a shirt there sold by a company that treats those workers unfairly, and I can do something as a consumer alone. And in groups, of course, using media tools, we can organize a boycott of those companies who do those bad things, and we can help to improve the situation of those workers. Partly that's what I'm on about when I say being aware of what happens at the point of production, not the consumption. But you can bring them together, right? I'm a consumer, I buy the shirt, I either decide not to buy the shirt from any of the sources that I know operate like that in Bangladesh, or I can be more active, right? I can go to the store where I buy the Joe's t-shirt produced in Bangladesh, and I can ask to talk to the manager and all this other stuff, and I can say, I want to have evidence from you out here when I come into the store to buy anything from Bangladesh, that you and your company are paying those folks more back there in Bangladesh, or that you're going to contribute to the UN-organized compensation fund, or even the corporately organized compensation fund. There's two of them, by the way. So there's that. I was responding to this young gentleman saying, I wish that Sandel had talked more about the consumer who is also a working person, and the problem of these two spheres in that person's mind. When you go to work, you obey the boss. You don't ask questions. That, in effect, is obeying the rational choice perspective on how all of us are only motivated by our economic interests in life. You and I know we're motivated by a heck of a lot more than that, and we certainly hope so. But the way that our jobs are organized in a way doesn't permit us to be these fuller human beings. That's another kind of underlying point, I think, and lament of Sandel in this book. We're diminished as human beings to the degree that market values occupy more and more of our waking thought and our behaviors. And he would like to see us move out. I don't think he asked us to move out and consider things enough. And one of those ways is, what about as working people? Not just our awareness of other working people whose products we buy in this globalized economy, like chocolate or coffee or shirts or whatever. But what about us as working people? So I'm kind of asking Sandel to take one page from the Marxist tradition, from the critical economy tradition, that asserts that you're going to get a deeper understanding of the nature of your society if you think in terms of who owns the means of production, who does the work, under what conditions, for what kind of pay, what kind of profit, what's that mean for our society. And it keeps getting pushed away, and I think that's one of the reasons why I would argue we end up with a rather limp appeal from Sandel to individual conscience as a consumer. I'd like to say I think he goes further than that, but I didn't see him develop stuff that would allow me to say that. That's pretty harsh.
Yeah, I agree. He doesn't develop it that way. And I think that's something important to go into. But it seems to me that what he could do there, which I have some sympathy with, is to start treating human work as something whose value is degraded by being treated as a commodity, right? And there's lots of this in the Marxist tradition,
yes,
too.
Yes, sir.
When you move away from an economy of where the producers are their own boss and produce for a product that goes on the market, right? But they're not hired labor. There's something more. It's something more respectful of the dignity of human creative activity there. I saw a film, and probably you've seen it too, where it's a documentary about work in China, where they go through this factory, and there's just row upon row upon row of people sitting at a long tables and stuff coming by them. I mean, it reminded me immediately of Charlie Chaplin's great
yes.
film, right?
Modern Times.
Right. I mean, and, you know, the thing comes by, they take it, they twist something on it, put it back on there, go to the next one, twist it, goes back on, you know. And, I mean, the thing which was so astounding in this was how many of these people, I mean, the camera kept going on row after row after row after row, right? And so I said to my son, who's a avid reader of The Economist, I said, you know, this is horrible. I mean, is this what economic development in China means? And my son said, well, what's the alternative? And he said, and I said, well, you know, maybe first of all they could pay these people more, and so that they at least have somewhat more affluent lives outside the factory. And he said, yeah. I said, but that means the price of the product goes up, right? So you're not going to sell anywhere near as many of them in the United States. And consequently, actually, they'll be hiring less people. And I said, well, isn't that all right? And then my son says, well, look where they're coming from. They're coming from the agricultural sector of old China, where they're on the edge of starvation half the time. Is that any better? Is that what you want to relegate them to? You know, my son is keen on rational choice theory, and so you know, he had me completely stymied. I didn't know what to say.
Yeah, that isn't an easy one. One answer you might try is whether he's familiar with Henry Ford and Fordism. The small part of Fordism I'll refer to here is Henry Ford had the brilliance to figure that if he could get his workers paid enough to buy what they produced, he had an unending magical goose that laid a golden egg, because he no longer would have to sell to the few and the elite that could afford these cars, and he could then impose more efficiency and discipline at the point of production, because when you triple your pay, anybody would say, yeah, sure, speed up the line, dude, I can do it. And that's what happened. And so American workers became the big market, not the American plutocrats, for the American car that American workers were producing. Golden cycle, right? Now, one might say, and one sees evidence, that parts of the Chinese leadership are sure thinking like that. For one thing, they're not sure. They've read their economics textbooks, and they know when you come in on a product cycle and you got cheap labor, you can sell your commodity cheaply, you can greatly expand the numbers, but sooner or later other competitors come in, and sooner or later you got to pay your workers more, so the golden moment won't last forever. So China knows, I think, that they cannot continue with this particular export-led growth model. They're going to have to do domestic consumption. And the only way to do that is pay the workers more. So I'd say we'll be seeing that happening, actually, in China. Is it going to resolve the issues that we're talking about here? No, probably not. It'll probably create even greater alienation among the Chinese working population than currently exists, because they will come to replicate what we're doing.
I was wondering if there's if you can think of distinctions when we think of work. I still feel that we are thinking in that one trend, that it's considering things from that economic gain point of view, that those workers in China are better off that way, because consider where they were coming from, the agricultural place where they are facing. But how real is that? And is it real from that economic point of view, are there values that we, of which we are not aware, that happen in that agricultural sphere that we can't even speak of them because we are just engulfed by this view of they're better off now that they have a job? Is there like satisfaction in growing that potato, even though I'm going to be a little hungry, you know?
I certainly appreciate that realm of values, and I think we're making a mistake and limiting our understanding if we think in terms of what they used to call the push-pull factors. Rural poverty pushes people into the cities, and the idea of greater consumption, more money, a chance to move up in life is the pull factor. The city pulls the peasant from the countryside. Fair enough. Those are real dynamics in the context of today's China, just as they were real dynamics in the context of Britain's industrialization 200 years previously or so. The emptying of the rural population into the cities. I mean, where is the Chinese Dickens, right? To speak of us, of the dark satanic mills. Actually, there are quite a number of Chinese writers like that. I've just discovered a couple. And so there's an awful lot of awareness there. It's also specific to the Chinese experience, isn't it? Namely, there was a revolution there. And it was a rather major transformation. And the institutions of the revolution that affected the transformations in the countryside, the end of the landlord class, for example, communal production and so forth, were never perfect instruments, but they've been under severe attack and degradation since the embrace 30-odd years ago by Deng Xiaoping of the capitalist accumulation model for the future of the Chinese economy and its explicit export orientation rather than the provision of greater and greater amounts of goods and services to the Chinese population, that is the consumer economy. And that's a dilemma that they're facing now. Will they be able to maintain 10% growth, 8 to 10% GDP growth, especially in the West, stops buying their stuff, or when the prices of their stuff goes up, what are they going to do? Where are they going to sell it, right? Historically, you can only sell it to your own workers. They become the consumers. If you don't do that, you still got to find export markets, but everybody else is competing for the same export market, so it might not be so easy for them. But I'm making the point here that there's more than that old traditional reason why peasants would leave the farm in China. It is the breakdown of the institutions of the revolution in the countryside, so that for 400 to 800 million people, what seemed somewhat viable 30 years ago in the sense that the countryside fed itself and that public education and health care generally extended to all of the rural areas of China. But now, with the privatization of many things and the competition in a markedly divided, class-divided society with tremendous amounts of wealth being produced, there's more marginalization. There's marginalization in China that hasn't been seen for about 50 years, right? Pre-revolution. So there are tremendous stresses within Chinese society.
What do you mean by marginalization?
Well, the marginalization of the now rural poor in China, whose institutions no longer function. They've got to meet market mechanisms. They've got to deliver stuff as commodities from their villages. If they don't, there's no subsidy left anymore. There's that. And the poverty of the masses that move to the city and become workers there, living in terrible conditions and working in terrible conditions. They may or may not make the gap. As we know, the bulk of Chinese factory workers from the rural areas go home every year. They maintain a life in the countryside, even if it's just to go home one day to deliver a washing machine to mom, you know, after having saved for a year to buy that thing and take it home. So that's what I mean by marginalization. They're barely making it in town. They're not making enough to have the urban middle class lifestyle that is now all around them. But they can't really make it back home on the farm either. These are specific Chinese dynamics, but they've also existed when we've had modernizations and industrializations over the last 200 years. Rural populations become urbanized, they become secularized, they become organized as workers, and they meet with different degrees of exploitation. And a lot of them in China, as we know, are poorly paid, living and working in not very good situations that virtually none of us would find tolerable. And yet there's something to, well, what is the alternative? And we look back and say, well, gee, you know, capitalism developed in much the same way at great human cost with loss of rural community values. And then the creation of a huge mass of urban workers, often enough atomized, not in touch with each other. They've been cut asunder from their previous traditional ties, family, etc. Sociologists have written about this for a long, long time. A lot of alienation and isolation. Those populations become available for things. To be exploited, to be armies, to be the poor, to be the masses who go for an authoritarian, charismatic figure, like a Hitler. So there's a lot at play here. I've gone on too much.
Well, thanks so much, Fred. That was terrific. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. And Maude Barlow will be having her book launch, Blue Future, at